Chapter 68. Tony. The screen turned to static, but Marsha's voice continued to ring through the room. Deep transformation is possible, but you must detach from your beliefs and assumptions. I can smell smoke, said Zoe, her face white. That's right, Zoe. You can smell smoke. For this house, my house, is burning to the ground as we speak, said Marsha. Possessions mean nothing. Will you rise from the ashes? Remember, Buddha says, no one saves us but ourselves. Look, whispered Francis. Wisps of black smoke drifted sinuously beneath the locked, heavy oak door. Let us out! Jessica screamed so loudly, her voice turned hoarse. Can you hear me, Marsha? You let us out right now! The screen turned black. Marsha's absence was now as terrifying as her presence had been. We need to block that doorway, said Tony. But Heather and Napoleon were way ahead of him. Returning from the bathrooms carrying dripping wet towels that they were rolling into tight cylinders, as if this was their job, as if they'd been expecting exactly this situation. As they got to the door, the volume of smoke increased suddenly and frighteningly, pouring into the room like water. People began to cough. Tony's chest tightened. Everybody get back, shouted Napoleon as he and Heather shoved the rolled-up towels between the door and the floor, forming a tight seal. The low level of claustrophobia Tony had been experiencing ever since they first discovered the locked door threatened to turn into full-blown panic. He felt his breathing become ragged. Oh, God, he was going to lose it in front of all these people. He had no job to do. He couldn't even put the towels at the door because Heather and Napoleon were already doing it. He couldn't help. He couldn't kick down that door because it opened inwards. He couldn't fight anyone. He couldn't do a damned thing. He coughed so violently, his eyes filled with tears. Frances grabbed his hand and pulled. Get away from the door. He let her pull him back. She didn't let go of his hand. He didn't let go of hers. Everyone huddled at the point in the room furthest away from the door. Napoleon and Heather came and stood with them, their eyes already bloodshot from smoke. Napoleon pulled Zoe close to him and she buried her face in his shirt. The door didn't feel hot, he said. That's a good sign.
I think I can hear it, said Carmel. I can hear the fire.
They all went quiet. It sounded at first like heavy, settled rain, but it wasn't rain. It was the unmistakable crackle of flames. Something heavy and huge crashed to the ground above them. A wall? There was a dramatic whoosh of air, like wind in a storm, and then the flames grew louder. Jessica made a sound.
Are we all going to die down here? Asked Zoe.
She looked up at her father with disbelief.
Is she seriously going to let us die?
Certainly not, said Napoleon.
With such matter-of-fact, grown-up assurance, Tony wanted to believe Napoleon had special knowledge, except that Tony was a grown-up too, and he knew better. We'll all put wet towels over our heads and faces to protect us from smoke inhalation, said Heather. Then we'll just wait this thing out.
She sounded as calm and assured as her husband. Maybe Tony would be the same if one of his kids or grandkids were here. He thought of his children. They would grieve for him. Yes, of course his children would grieve for him. They wouldn't be ready to lose him, even though he didn't see them that often these days. This knowledge felt like a surprise, as if he'd spent the last few years pretending his children didn't love him, when he knew they loved their dad, for Christ's sake. He knew that. Late last year, Will forgot about the time difference and rang in the middle of the night from Holland to tell him about his latest promotion at work. "Sorry," he said. "I wanted to tell you first." 30 years old, and he still wanted his dad's praise. According to Mimi, James was always posting pictures from Tony's football career online. "He shows off about you," Mimi said, rolling her eyes. "Exploits your fame to pick up girls." Then there was Mimi herself, his baby, bustling about his house, setting things right. Every time she broke up with another dickhead, she turned up at his house to give him a hand. She couldn't lose her dad right now, when she was still dating dickheads. He wasn't ready to die. 56 years wasn't long enough. His life felt suddenly incredibly rich and abundant with possibility. He wanted to repaint the house, get another dog, a puppy. It wouldn't be betraying Banjo to get a puppy. He always got another puppy in the end. He wanted to go to the beach, eat a big breakfast at the cafe down the road while he read the paper. Listen to music. It was like he'd forgotten music existed. He wanted to travel to Holland and see his granddaughter perform in one of those stupid Irish dancing competitions. He looked at Carmel, who he had written off as a kooky intellectual because of her glasses. He'd asked her how she came to teach English to refugees, and she explained that her dad was a refugee from Romania back in the 50s, and a next-door neighbour took it upon herself to teach him English. "My dad didn't have any aptitude for languages," said Carmel, "and he's very impatient when he feels insecure. It would have been a tough slog. So my sister and I both teach English as a second language now, to honour Auntie Pat." Who the fuck did Tony honour? Who the fuck did Tony help out? He didn't even give back to the sport that had given him so much joy. Mimi had been at him for ages to coach a local team of kids. "You might even enjoy it," she said. Why had he been so against the idea? Now he couldn't think of anything more wonderful than standing on a field in the sunlight, teaching kids to see the music and poetry of football. He met the frightened eyes of the woman whose hand he still held. She was as nutty as a fruitcake, talked too much, had clearly never seen an AFL game in her life. She wrote romance books for a living. Tony hadn't read a novel since high school. They had nothing in common. He didn't want to die. He wanted to take her out for a drink. Chapter 69. Francis. The 9 guests huddled in the furthest corner of the yoga and meditation studio, wet towels draped over their heads and shoulders, while Tranquillum House burned to the ground. Frances listened to the sound of the hungry flames and wondered if the crash she'd just heard was that beautiful staircase.
She remembered how Yao had said on that first day, "We won't sink, Francis," and imagined ripples of fire consuming that beautiful wood. "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name," murmured Jessica into her knees over and over. "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." Francis wouldn't have picked Jessica as a believer, but maybe she wasn't, because she couldn't seem to get any further than, "Hallowed be thy name." Francis, who had been brought up Anglican, but lost religion sometime back in the late 80s, thought it might not be good manners to pray for deliverance right now, when she hadn't even said thank you for so long. God might have appreciated a thank you card over the years. "Thank you for that long, hot, sex-filled summer in Europe with Sol. Thank you for that first year of my marriage to Henry, which, to be honest, God, was one of the happiest of my life. Thank you for a career that has given me virtually nothing but pleasure, and I'm sorry for all that fuss about the review. I'm sure that reviewer is one of God's children too. Thank you for my health. You've been quite generous in that regard, and it was rude of me to make such a fuss over a bad cold. Thank you for friends, who are more like family. Thank you for my dad, even though you took him a little early. Thank you for Bellinis and all champagne cocktails. Sorry for complaining about a paper cut while others suffered atrocities. Although, to be frank, that's why I gave up believing in you. That whole paper cuts for some versus atrocity for others thing." Carmel cried into her wet towel and jumped at the sound of yet another crash. Frances imagined the balcony of her room hanging at an angle and then smashing to the ground in a shower of embers. She imagined billows of black smoke illuminated by fiery light against a summer night sky. "The smoke in here isn't getting any worse," she said to Carmel to be comforting. "Napoleon and Heather did a good job with the towels." She could still smell and taste smoke, but it was true. It wasn't getting any worse. "We might be fine," said Francis tentatively. "We will be fine," said Napoleon. He sat between his wife and daughter, holding their hands. "It's all going to be fine." He spoke with such assurance, and Francis wished she hadn't caught sight of his face as he readjusted the wet towel, because it was filled with despair. "It's coming for us," she thought. "It's coming for us, and there is nowhere to hide." She remembered Marcia saying, "I wonder, do you feel that you've ever been truly tested in your life?" Jessica lifted her head from her knees and spoke in a muffled voice through her towel. "She never even heard all our presentations." It was cute the way she still wanted to see logic in Marcia's actions. She would have been the kid who couldn't stand it when the teacher forgot to do the quiz that had been promised. "Do you think Yao is still alive?" asked Zoe. Chapter 70. Yao. Yao dreamed of Finn. Finn was very keen that Yao wake up. "Wake up," he said insistently. He banged together a pair of cymbals.
He blasted a horn in Yao's ear. "Mate, you really need to wake up to yourself."
Yao returned to consciousness while Finn receded. He felt the imprint of something soft and scratchy against his cheek. He lifted his head. There was a cushion on Marsha's desk. He remembered the feeling of the needle in his neck.
The surprise of it, because that was not a decision he could respect. He heard the sound of something burning. He smelled smoke.
He lifted his head, turned around, and saw her smoking a cigarette, looking out the window. She turned to face him and smiled. She looked sad and emotional, but resigned, like his fiancée when she broke off their engagement. Marsha said, "Hello, Yao." Yao knew it was over, and he knew he'd never love anyone ever again quite the way he loved this strange woman. His voice rasped in his throat.
"What have you done?"
Chapter 71. Francis. Still it went on, the burning, the crashing. Francis's fear peaked and then plateaued. Her heart rate slowed. A great tiredness swept over her. She had always wondered how she would feel if her life was in mortal danger. What would she do if her plane began to plummet towards Earth? If a crazed gunman put the barrel to her head? If she was ever truly tested? Now she knew. She wouldn't believe it. She would keep thinking right until the last word that her story would never stop, because there could be no story without her. Things would keep happening to her. It was impossible to truly believe that there would be a final page. Another crash. Carmel startled again.
"Wait a moment," said Lars sharply. "That sound, it's the same sound as before. It's exactly the same."
Frances looked at him. She didn't understand. Napoleon sat up straighter. He removed the towel from his face. Jessica said,
"There is a pattern, isn't there? I knew there was a pattern. Crackle, whoosh, small bang, crackle, 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 huge scary bang."
Francis said, "I'm sorry, I don't get it."
"It's on a loop," said Tony.
"You mean it's a recording?" said Ben.
"We're listening to a recording."
Frances couldn't get her head around it.
"There's no fire?"
She could see the fire clearly in her head.
"But we saw smoke. We smelled smoke," said Heather. "Where there's smoke, there's fire."
"Maybe it's a controlled fire," said Zoe. "She wants us to think we're in danger."
"So this is her way of making us look death in the face," said Tony.
"I knew she wouldn't let us die," said Carmel.
Lars threw the wet cloth on the floor and went to stand in front of the screen.
"Well done, Marsha," he shouted. "You've successfully scared us all half to death, and we'll never be the same again. Could we please go back to our rooms now?"
Nothing.
You can't keep us in here forever, Marcia, said Lars. What's that mantra you keep repeating? Nothing lasts forever. He smiled ruefully and pushed his damp hair back from his forehead. We feel like we've been down here forever. Nothing lasts forever, thought Francis. Marcia had made a point of saying that so many times. Nothing lasts forever. Nothing lasts forever. She remembered how she'd told Marcia there was no code in the doll, and Marcia had answered, exactly. Francis said now, when was the last time someone tried the door? I honestly think we've tried every possible code combination there could be, said Napoleon. I don't mean the code, said Francis. I mean the door handle. When was the last time someone tried the door handle? Chapter 72. Yao.
Did you sleep well? Asked Marcia.
She took a drag of her cigarette. Yao ran a diagnostic eye over her. Dilated pupils, sheen of sweat on her forehead, fidgeting.
Did you have a smoothie? He asked.
He lifted an empty Doritos packet from Marcia's desk, shook it, and watched the yellow crumbs fall. If she'd eaten Doritos, she had to be in an altered state. The Doritos were more shocking than the cigarette.
I did.
Marcia exhaled smoke and smiled at him.
The smoothie was delicious, and I have been experiencing many remarkable insights.
He'd never seen her smoke. She made smoking look beautiful. Yao had never smoked, and now he wanted to try it. It looked natural and sensual, the smoke curling languidly from her fingers. He remembered the first time he met her, 10 years ago in that big office, and how she'd smelled of cigarette smoke. Yao looked at the computer screen on her desk. A clip of a burning two-story house. An eave crashed to the ground. You sedated me, said Yao. He ran his tongue around his dry mouth. He felt dull-witted with shock. He couldn't quite comprehend that she had done this.
Yes, I did, said Marcia. I had no choice.
The sky outside the window began to lighten. The guests? Asked Yao. Are they still down there? Marcia shrugged moodily.
I don't know. I am sick of them. I am sick of this industry.
She took another drag of her cigarette and brightened.
I've made a decision. I'm going back to FMCG.
FMCG? Asked Yao.
Fast-moving consumer goods, said Marcia.
Like toothpaste, said Yao.
Exactly like toothpaste. Would you like to come and work with me?
What?
No.
He stared at her. She was still Marcia. She still had that extraordinary body, still wore that extraordinary dress. And yet he could feel her power over him slipping away, as he watched her morphing back into the corporate executive she'd once been. How was that possible? He felt as betrayed as if a lover had admitted infidelity. This wasn't just a job for him. It was his life, his home. It was virtually his religion. And now she wanted to leave it all behind to go and sell toothpaste? Wasn't toothpaste part of the ordinary world they had turned their backs on? She didn't mean it. It had to be the smoothie talking. This was not an example of a transcendental insight. With her medical history, she should not have had the smoothie, but now she had. She should be lying down with her headphones on, and then Yao could guide her psychedelic experience away from toothpaste. But right now, he had 9 guests to worry about. He looked away from her and turned off the burning house footage on the computer. He clicked onto the security program that showed the yoga and meditation studio. There was no one there. Crumpled towels lay all over the floor of the deserted room. "They're out," said Yao. "How did they escape?" Marcia sniffed.
"They finally worked it out. The door has been unlocked for hours."
Chapter 73. Carmel. All the men insisted on walking ahead of the women up the stairs from the yoga and meditation studio, ready to slay lions or wellness consultants offering smoothies. It was kind and gentlemanly, and Carmel appreciated it and felt glad not to be a man, but it seemed their chivalry was unnecessary. The house was silent and empty. Carmel still couldn't believe there was no fire. The images in her head had been so real. She had thought she wouldn't see her children again.
"Surely it won't just open," Heather had said when they all stood at the door and Napoleon put his hand on the handle, insisting they all stay back, stay back, stay back.
It opened, as if it had never been locked at all, to reveal a steel rubbish bin sitting directly outside the door. Napoleon tilted it forward and showed them the contents. There were burnt fragments of newspaper at the bottom and a pile of melted, misshapen plastic water bottles on top. There were still a few glowing red embers left, but that was all that remained of the towering inferno they had all imagined. They wandered as a group into the empty dining room and looked at the long table where they'd shared their silent meals. Grey morning light filled the room. Magpies warbled, and a kookaburra laughed its liquid laugh. The dawn chorus had never sounded so lyrical. Life felt exquisitely ordinary.
"We should find a phone," said Heather. "Call the police."
"We should just leave," said Ben. "Find our cars and get the hell out of here."
Nobody did anything. Carmel pulled out a chair and sat down, her elbows on the table. She felt the same shocked sense of ecstatic relief as she had just after giving birth. All that shouting of instructions, all that fear, all that fuss. Over and out.
"Do you think anyone is here in the house at all?"
"Wait, someone is coming," said Lars.
Footsteps approached down the hallway.
"Good morning."
It was Yao. He carried a huge platter of tropical fruit. He looked tired, but otherwise in perfect health. "Please, take your seats. We have a delicious breakfast prepared for you." He placed the platter on the table.
"Wow," thought Carmel. "He's going to pretend everything is normal."
Zoe burst into tears.
"We thought you were dead."
Yao's smile wavered.
"Dead? Why would you think I was dead?"
"You looked pretty out of it, mate," said Tony. "We had to play a game called Death Row," Frances told him, from an armchair by the door. She looked just like one of Carmel's daughters telling tales about her sibling. "It was a horrible game." Her voice trailed off.
Yao straightened a bunch of purple grapes that was slipping off the side of the platter. He frowned.
Carmel took up the slack. "We had to pretend to be lawyers."
She remembered that exhilarating moment when she'd spouted all that meaningless jargon that was nevertheless so meaningful to Marcia. It had been terrifying, but also wonderful, like a fairground ride that had flipped her upside down and then round and round. "We had to argue for a stay of execution. I defended Zoe." As she spoke, she realized how farcical it sounded. It was so obviously all just a game. Why had they taken it so seriously? If they told the police about it, they would surely just laugh.
"And then she never even let us complete the activity," complained Jessica.
"Yes, I was quite looking forward to my turn," said Frances.
"You were not," said Heather.
Carmel took a single grape from the fruit platter, even though she didn't feel especially hungry. She must have gone beyond hunger. She bit straight through the center of the grape.
"Oh my God," she thought, as the juice exploded in her mouth. She shuddered with gratitude. It was like all the cells of her body reacted to this tiny sustenance. She felt like she was close to some amazingly complex yet breathtakingly simple revelation about the true precious beauty of food. Food wasn't the enemy. Food gave her life.
"I know. Some of last night's activities might have seemed unusual," said Yao.
He was a little hoarse, but you had to admire him. He was continuing to play his violin as the Titanic sank beneath the sea.
"But everything that happened was designed for your personal growth."
"Cut the shit, Yao," said Lars. "You must know it's all over. We can't let anyone else go through what we went through last night."
"We have to close you down, mate," said Tony.
"That boss of yours has to go straight to a secure psychiatric ward," said Heather.
"I will not be going to any ward," said Marcia.
Carmel's heart leaped in her chest. Marcia stood in the doorway of the dining room, wearing a Hillary Clinton-style red pantsuit that looked 10 years out of date and 3 sizes too big for her.
"I'm going back to work."
"She's still flying high as a kite," said Ben.
"Marcia,
said Yao despairingly. I thought you were resting.
You all look so well.
Masha studied the group.
Much thinner, much healthier. I'm sure you are all happy with your results.
Heather made a derisive sound. We're thrilled, Masha. We're just thrilled with our results. This has been so relaxing.
Masha's nostrils flared. Don't use that sarcastic tone. You report to me. I have authority to...
Not this again, said Heather. You're my boss, are you? We all work for you? We've all got to do a PowerPoint presentation now, or what?
You execute us?
She imitated Marsha's accent.
That's not helpful, my love, said Napoleon.
I know all about you, Heather, said Masha slowly. I was there last night. I heard your secrets. You told me everything. You tell me I gave drugs to your daughter. I am such a terrible person to do this, even though I did it to help you and your family. Well, you tell me this. What drugs did you allow your son to take?
Masha's fists were clenched. She held something tightly in her right hand. Carmel couldn't see what it was.
What sort of mother are you? Masha asked Heather.
There was a strange, powerful animosity between these two women that Carmel didn't understand.
That's enough, said Napoleon.
Yao moved across the room towards Masha as Heather responded to her comment with a peal of scornful laughter. She said,
I'm a better mother than you would ever be.
Masha roared like an animal. She leapt at Heather, a silver dagger held high, ready to plunge into her neck. Napoleon jumped in front of his wife, and Yao jumped in front of Masha at the exact moment Frances stood from her chair, grabbed the candelabrum from the sideboard, and swung it wildly at Masha's head. Masha fell instantly. She lay at Frances's feet without moving.
Oh, God, said Frances.
The candelabrum hung in her hand. She looked up at everyone, her face filled with horror.
Have I killed her?
Chapter 74 Frances. Afterwards, Frances would try to work through her decision-making process, but she never could. It was like her brain short-circuited. She saw the 200-year-old letter opener in Marsha's hand.
Careful. That letter opener is as sharp as a dagger. You could murder someone with that, Frances.
She saw Masha lunge for Heather. She felt the unexpected heaviness of the candelabrum in her hand. And the next thing, Masha was lying at her feet, and Frances had her hands in the air like a criminal because a large policeman was pointing a gun directly at her and saying, "Don't move, please." The well-mannered cop was Gus, Jan the massage therapist's boyfriend, and he was just as lovely as Frances had imagined him to be, especially once he put his gun away. Gus did not charge Frances with the murder of Masha because Masha was not dead. After just a few terrifying moments, she sat up, a hand to the back of her head, and told Frances she was fired, effective immediately. Jan, wearing a summer dress, was with Gus.
looking flushed and excited at the events that had transpired at her workplace. Apparently, she and Gus had been chatting in the middle of the night. From their glances, Frances deduced it was a post-coital chat, and Gus mentioned that at the end of his shift, he'd pulled over a girl driving a yellow Lamborghini for speeding. It was immediately obvious to Jan from Gus's description that this girl could only be Delilah, and as it seemed unlikely that there could be two yellow Lamborghinis in the area, and it therefore looked like Delilah might have stolen a guest's car, and as Jan was already suspicious about the fact that nearly all the Tranquillum House staff had been asked to leave during the middle of a retreat, which the chef told her had never happened before, she had convinced Gus to drive straight to the house with her to check things out. "She's probably concussed," said Yao, after examining his boss. "Or it might be that she's still tripping." Gus said that he wouldn't be charging Frances with assault because there were multiple witnesses who all confirmed that her quick actions had most likely saved Heather's life. Although Frances knew that Heather might have been Marsha's target, but the only ones in danger were Napoleon, who had pushed Heather aside, and Yao, who had placed himself directly in front of Marsha. Heather said, "Thank you, Frances." She put a hand to the side of her neck and considered the potential murder weapon. That could have been quite nasty. Heather refused to acknowledge Marsha at all, right up until when the ambulance arrived and took Marsha to the local hospital.
"Thank you for visiting. Please remember to rate your stay with us on TripAdvisor," she cried out merrily as the two blue-uniformed paramedics led her away. More local police officers turned up, and then once Gus and his friends discovered the large quantities of illegal drugs on the premises, a second group arrived. And these ones had harder eyes and shinier shoes, and they weren't quite as interested in the extraneous details as Gus was. Yao was taken away in a police car to make a statement. Before he left, he turned to them all and said simply, "I'm very sorry." He looked sad and defeated and ashamed, like a teenage boy who has had a party get out of control while his parents are away. Ben's Lamborghini was found in the car park of the regional airport 2 hours' drive away. It was supposedly not damaged, although Ben would see about that. Delilah had not yet been located. There was a lot of tedious paperwork. Everyone had to give long, separate statements to the police about the events that had transpired over the last week. It was hard sometimes to give a logical account of what happened. Frances could sense their skepticism.
"So you thought you were locked up? You were locked up. But then you just opened the door and left?"
"Well, you see, we'd stopped trying the handle," said Frances. "I think that was the point Marsha was trying to make, that sometimes the answer is right there in front of you."
"I see," said the police officer.
You could tell from his face that he didn't see at all, and that he sure as hell wouldn't have got himself locked in that room.
"And you thought there was a fire?"
"There was smoke," said Frances, her mouth full of mango, the golden flesh as fresh and sweet as a summer morning, "and the sounds of a fire, which in reality was a YouTube clip of a house burning down played over an intercom," said the cop without inflection.
"It was very convincing," said Frances unconvincingly.
I'm sure it was, said the cop. You could see it was taking all his willpower not to roll his eyes.
You have...
He pointed at her face. Frances wiped her sticky chin. Thanks. Don't you just love summer fruit?
Not really a fan.
Not a fan of fruit?
Lars, the only member of the group with any legal expertise, tried to ensure everyone stayed on message.
We were tricked. We had no idea there were drugs on the premises, he said loud enough for everyone to hear as he was led off for his interview. We were not told what those smoothies contained.
I had no idea there were drugs on the premises, said Frances again. I was tricked. I was not told what those smoothies contained.
Yeah, I know, said the policeman. He gave up trying and rolled his eyes.
None of you did.
He closed his notebook. I'll let you get back to your mango.
One of the local cops recognized Tony and drove back home to get a Carlton shirt for him to sign and got quite teary about it. Finally, as the long day began to draw to a close and the drugs were removed as evidence, they were all told that they were free to leave, as long as they made themselves available for any future questioning.
We're free to leave, but are we free to stay? Frances asked Gus, the last police officer there. It was too late in the day to drive 6 hours back home. Gus said he didn't see why not, as it was no longer an active crime scene. No one had died, and the drugs were gone, and they were technically still paying guests. He seemed to be working through the legalities in his mind, reassuring himself of his decision. Jan gave everyone a 10-minute mini-massage to release tension. She said they might want to get themselves checked out at the local hospital, but no one felt inclined to do so, especially as that was where Marcia had been taken. Tony said his shoulder was perfectly fine.
Is this what you meant when you said don't do anything you're not comfortable with? Frances asked Jan when it was her turn for a massage.
Poor Jan was horrified. I meant don't do burpees or jumping lunges, she said, as her practiced fingers performed their magic on Frances's shoulders. Burpees are terrible for anyone with back issues, and you've got to have really stable knees before you do a jumping lunge.
She shook her head. If I'd suspected anything like this, I would have informed the police immediately.
She looked adoringly at Gus.
I would have informed Gus.
Does he whistle? Asked Frances, following her gaze. Apparently he didn't whistle or whittle, but was still just about perfect. Once Gus and Jan had left, the nine of them went into the kitchen to prepare something for their dinner. They were euphoric with freedom as they flung open cupboards, and there was a moment of awed silence as they all stood in front of the massive stainless steel refrigerator and saw the abundance of food it contained. Steak, chicken, fish, vegetables, eggs.
Today is my 21st birthday, announced Zoe. They all turned to look at her.
It's also Zach's birthday.
She took a deep, shaky breath.
It's our birthday. Today.
Her parents moved to stand on either side of her.
I think we might need a little glass of wine with our dinner, said Frances.
We need music, said Ben.
We need a cake, said Carmel. She rolled up her sleeves. I'm a master baker of birthday cakes.
I can make pizza, said Tony, if there's flour. I can make pizza dough.
Can you? Said Francis.
I can, he said, and he smiled.
Zoe retrieved the bottle of wine she'd smuggled in from her bedroom, and Francis searched the house until she found a gold mine of presumably uncollected contraband brought in by previous guests, including 6 bottles of wine, some of which looked quite good, in a small room behind the reception desk. Ben found their mobile phones, and they reconnected with the world and discovered not all that much had happened in the last week. A sporting scandal that only Tony and Napoleon found scandalous, the breakup of a Kardashian marriage that only Jessica and Zoe found relevant, and a natural disaster where the only fatalities involved those who flagrantly ignored warnings. So, you know. Ben used his phone to play music and took on the responsibility of DJ, accepting requests across generations and genres. Everyone got drunk on wine and food. Jessica grilled perfect medium-rare steaks. Tony twirled pizza dough. Francis acted as sous chef to whoever needed her. Carmel made an incredible cake and became flushed and beautiful at all the praise that was heaped upon her. A surprising number of people danced, and a surprising number of people cried. Lars could not dance at all. It was delightful to watch. Are you doing it on purpose? Asked Francis.
Why do people always ask that? Said Lars.
Tony could dance very well. He told them that back in the day, he and some other players had done ballet classes as part of their training.
Helped build up my hamstrings, he explained,
as Francis and Carmel clutched each other and giggled helplessly at the thought of Tony in a tutu. He responded by executing a perfect pirouette. Francis had never been in a relationship with a man who could pirouette or make pizza dough. That was just something interesting to note and not a reason to let Tony kiss her. She knew he wanted to kiss her. The feeling of being at a party with a man who wanted to kiss her but had not yet done so, was exactly as good as the first time she experienced it, at the age of 15, at Natalie's 16th birthday party. It heightened everything, just like a hallucinogenic drug. They toasted Zoe and Zach.
I didn't want twins, said Heather, holding up her glass of red wine. When the doctor told me it was twins, I'm not going to lie, I said a 4-letter word.
Well, that's a great start, Mum, said Zoe.
I'm a midwife, said Heather, ignoring her. I knew the risks of a twin pregnancy. But it turned out the pregnancy didn't give me any trouble at all. I had a natural birth. Of course, they gave me a lot of trouble once they were out in the world.
She looked at Napoleon. He took her hand. Those first few months were hard. But then, I don't know, I think we got them into a routine when they were about 6 months old. And I remember, after I finally got a good night's sleep, I woke up, looked at them, and thought, well, you two are pretty special. They always took it in turns to do things first. Zach was born first, but Zoe walked first. Zach ran first. Her words faded a little.
She went to take a sip of wine and then remembered she hadn't finished her toast. Zoe got her driver's license first, which, as you can imagine, made Zach crazy. She stopped again. The fights! You would not believe the fights they had. They'd be wanting to kill each other, and I'd put them in separate rooms, but within 5 minutes, they'd be back together again, playing and giggling. Frances realized that Heather was giving the exact speech she would have given if Zach hadn't died. An ordinary, proud mum speech in a backyard, with the younger generations rolling their eyes and the older generation brushing away tears. She held up her glass. To Zoe and Zach, the smartest, funniest, most beautiful kids in the world. Your dad and I love you. Everyone held up their glasses and said after her, to Zoe and Zach. Napoleon and Zoe didn't do a toast. Instead, Napoleon lit the candles on Carmel's cake and they all sang happy birthday, and Zoe blew out the candles. And no one said, make a wish, because every single person in that room was wishing the same thing. Frances could see him so clearly, the boy who should have been there, sitting shoulder to shoulder with Zoe, jostling with her to blow out the candles, their lives ahead of them. After plates were handed around with the excellent cake, Zoe demanded that Ben play a song that Frances didn't recognize. And Ben played it, and he and Jessica and Zoe danced together. There were promises to keep in touch. People friended and followed each other. Jessica set up a WhatsApp group on their phones and joined them all. Carmel was the first one to succumb to exhaustion and say, good night. Everyone was leaving for home the next morning. Those who were from interstate had changed their flights and transfers to the next day, a day earlier than anticipated. Carmel was from Adelaide, and the Marconi family and Tony were from Melbourne. Tony was the only interstate guest who had hired a rental car, and he was going to drive Ben and Jessica to pick up their car from where it had been abandoned by Delilah. Lars and Frances, the only guests from Sydney, had declared their intentions to sleep late and have a lazy breakfast before heading off. Frances somehow already knew that everything was going to feel different in the morning. They would all feel the tug of their old lives. She'd been on group package holidays and cruises before. She knew the process. The further away they got from Tranquillum House, the more they would think, wait, what was that all about? I have nothing in common with those people. It would all begin to feel like a dream. Did I really do a Hawaiian dance by the pool? Did I really attempt to do a charade of the Kama Sutra just so my team would win? Did I really take illegal drugs and get locked up with strangers? At last, there was just Frances and Tony, alone at the long table, drinking a final glass of wine. Tony held up the bottle. Refill? Frances looked at her glass, considered, no, thank you. He went to refill his own glass, changed his mind, and put the bottle back down. I must be transformed, said Frances. Normally, I'd say yes. Me too, said Tony. He got that decisive, focused, I'm going in look men got on their faces when they decided it was time to kiss you. Frances thought of that first kiss at Natalie's 16th birthday party. How incredible and glorious it was. And how that was the boy who ended up telling her that he preferred smaller breasts. She thought of Gillian telling her to stop acting like the heroine of one of her own novels. Tony lived in Melbourne and was no doubt very settled in his life there. She thought of how often she'd moved for a man, how she'd been prepared to pack up her life and move to America for a man who didn't even exist. She thought of Marcia asking, "Do you want to be a different person when you leave here?" She said to Tony, "Normally, I'd say yes."